Welcome to H101, World History after 1500. Lecture 6, The Rise of the State in Europe. As I said in the first lecture, one tendency in world history is the rise of the capitalist world system, with which I dealt in the previous three lectures. Another one is the rise of an increasingly powerful totalitarian state, a state that constantly infringes upon and that constantly surveys our private sphere, something we tend to take more or less for granted, as we have internalized the notion that the state has the right to do so, and as we simply assume that if it does so, the state has more or less benign intentions. For example, the state now knows where you live, what your income is, and heck, if you've chipped your pet, it even knows the name and date of the birth of your cat. Now if we go back 500 years, one thing which is now very difficult for us to imagine is that at least the central state had then little authority, or was to its average citizen as remote as, say, the European Union would be to for an average citizen of any of its member countries now. If you live, for example, in a city, you paid taxes, which seldomly exceeded 4 to 6% of your income, to the municipality in which you lived. That municipality might then, occasionally, and only if the king begged for it long and hard, and a very small part of that, mostly only in the form of a loan, to the king. Many European countries had a Supreme Court, but to the average citizen, that was very remote indeed. People instead were being tried by the city's court, that had its own set of laws, fixed in privileges, handed to the city mostly a few hundred years ago. The state was something very remote. The state meant the king, whom you might perhaps have seen once in your lifetime, if he had happened to have made a solemn entry in your city. You could then cheer or yell at him, for in the 15th century most kings still constantly moved around and did not have any fixed residence. Otherwise, the king was a very remote figure you might have heard about, and the word state as an abstraction meant nothing to people in the 15th century. And furthermore, and this is a thing even many historians find hard to fathom, people did not become subjects of the state by birth, but because they wished to be subjects of the state. Cities, or for the countryside, local assemblies, became subjects by a solemn oath, in which they swore to obey the sovereign, but which the sovereign had duties to them as well. In particular, that he was not to abuse his authority by transgressing upon local privileges. And such privileges were very far-reaching. Entire provinces were only subject to the king on condition that they retained their own laws, raised their own taxes, they might even have their own armies. And the king had no right to transgress on all this by force of the solemn oath. Given that the kings had only been granted sovereignty over a province, if I would not encroach upon the privileges of a province. The kind of uniform fiscal system modern states at least aim for was impossible. Thus, for example, in France, the only direct tax people paid was the taille, a very small sum, less than 5% of income. In northern France, the taille was levied by personal income, and nobles did not pay taille at all, right into the late 18th century, and this was actually a major cause for the French Revolution. In the south, the taille depended on the status of land, and nobles had to pay taxes on land which was not possessed by nobles. And Burgundy paid no taille at all, so too did many cities. Large provincial entities in 15th century Europe had, as said in the previous lecture, the size of Luxembourg. More commonly they were, as I said there too, of the size of the three residuals of such entities, Monaco, San Marino, and Andorra. The sovereign co-principality of Andorra, recognized as a sovereign state by the United Nations in 1993, is actually a good illustration of a situation common in the 15th century. It was jointly administered by force of a treaty 1235 by the Counts of Foix in France, a responsibility that, on the disappearance of the County of Foix in the 16th century by the President of France, as it were, stand-in for the Counts of Foix, and, on the other side, by the Bishop of Urgel in Spain, as co-ruler of Andorra. If the concept of dual sovereignty will probably already be hard to fathom for American listeners, even stranger might be that of the then equally common enclaves, that is, pieces of one country laying within the boundary of another country, of which the best known example, and one of the few remaining, is the village of Baarle-Hertog, a piece of Belgian territory in the middle of the Dutch province of Brabant. Basically, up to the Peace of Vienna in 1815, when this matter was somewhat straightened out, this was a very common situation in Europe. For example, the territory of Limburg, most of which was, after 1648, part of the Dutch Republic, was everywhere intersected by territories that belonged to the Prince Bishops of Liège. I mention such oddities, as the whole of Europe was in the 15th century an array of what we might now term oddball states. For these states do not correspond to any form of state we are now familiar with. And we should by no means assume, as far too many historians, let alone political scientists, do, that the road which eventually led to the modern nation-state was in 1500 a foregone conclusion. Thus, for example, there were the theocracies, such as the aforementioned Prince Bishops of Liège, where the church authority was at once also the ruler. The best known was the largest, the Papal States, now confined to the Vatican, but in the 15th century the Papal States covered all of Middle Italy. Such theocracies, however, existed all over Europe. Then there were the peasant democracies. The proud survivor of these peasant democracies is the old Confederation of Switzerland. The Swiss Confederation was founded by way of a solemn covenant of the cantons of Uri, Swiss and Unterwald in 1291, and it practiced a system of direct democracy that is entirely different from modern representative democracy, and that is completely different too of the democracy practiced in ancient Greece. Of the direct democracy, every inhabitant with land within the border of a canton can vote on laws prepared by the federal government. If laws are voted down by the majority, they are not binding for the canton. Furthermore, the assembly of the canton elects judges and other officials. While Switzerland was somewhat exceptional in that it fought attempts of the House of Habsburg, which originally comes from Switzerland, to bring it back under the feudal yoke for nearly 300 years, and that made the Swiss to the most feared soldiers in all of Europe, peasant democracies were really nothing exceptional in 15th century Europe. Still abstracting from the old other and far older democracy that reaches back into the 11th century, as it was, well, rather remote, Iceland, peasant democracy also existed in the present Dutch province of Friesland, which, after the Frisian peasants had defeated an attempt to impose feudal rule from Holland on them at the Battle of Warns in 1385, was under so-called Frisian liberty until 1513. Under Frisian liberty, in a very similar way as in Switzerland, peasants too voted in assemblies. Then again, there were the city-states. These included a near great power in the 15th century, the Republic of Venice. And since the Republic of Venice had existed from 1185 and was to endure until 1806, the longest existing state in all of Europe, its very existence was also a continual challenge to all such propagandists of royal rule that argued that unless people were subjected to the unchallenged power of a king, chaos would ensue. But the city-states included such minuscule territories as the free city of Lucca, very close to Pisa, and not much larger than an average American suburb, or in the north, for example, the free cities of Groningen and the surrounding countryside in the Netherlands, or Hamburg in the Holy Roman Empire. Indeed, Hamburg has still not entirely shed the idea that it merely belongs to Germany by coincidence. Again, in Eastern Europe, for one way, Eastern European kings tried enticing German colonists to settle in their lands in the 13th and 14th centuries, was by promising them complete exemption from the laws of the Ram, Gdansk and Torun in Poland, Cluj and Brasov in present Romania, then part of Hungary. later part of the Ottoman Empire, which more or less respected the status of these cities as free city-states. Likely the oldest city-state of them all was the free city-state of Dubrovnik, Rakusa, in present Croatia, that was ruled by an elected city council, and that was dominated by an Italian-speaking merchant bourgeois. A bourgeois that had patterned its entire way of life on Renaissance Italy. And yet, Dubrovnik was part of the Ottoman Empire. Again, there were a great many city-states that were virtually independent, but merely nominally bound to some overlord by solemn oath. The most famous example of these free cities was probably the northern industrial metropolis of Ghent, that was under the largely nominal overlordship of the Dukes of Burgundy, but in reality virtually independent. What made these city-states such a threat to established kings and lords was that once a peasant had become subject of a city-state, he was no serf anymore, and commonly was not under any form of lordly jurisdiction either. And by the 14th into the 15th century, cities were steadily expanding their power over the surrounding countryside. Finally, there were the, to the listeners, more familiar kingdoms or duchies. The idea in the Middle Ages was that individuals, in a way, were naturally subjected to a single ruler who was anointed by God. Yet the ruler was bound to his subjects too. If he were behaving unjustly, the subjects could abjure him and choose another ruler. A law, therefore, always had to be for the common good of the multitude, rather than for the private good of the ruler, lest it constitute tyranny. The king could therefore only make laws in consultation with the good men of the realm. This good of the multitude was by the end of the 14th century everywhere in European kingdoms expressed in the estates. In England, these were called the House of Lords and the House of Commons. In Germany, they were called the Reichstag. In Spain and Portugal, they were called the Cortes. In Holland, they were called Staten-Generaal. In Poland, Sejm. And in Hungary, Orszak Kules, where I apologize for my pronunciation of Hungarian. The estates were legislative assemblies that represented the nobility, the clergy, and the common man. In some places, as in heavily urbanized Holland and Flanders, the estates largely represented the towns. In most other places, there was a careful balance. In most places, there was a careful balance between towns and nobles. And in Europe's arguably most powerful state, the vast kingdom of Poland-Lithuania, the estates largely represented the nobility. But not merely the nobility, as cities were represented in the sachem too. Aside from which, the nobility of Poland, represented by the sachem, was an exceptionally large group, some 12% of the population, that ranged from magnates, ruling vast estates, to petty farmers. Now in the 15th century, everywhere in Western Europe and Eastern Europe, the assemblies were steadily gaining ground on the monarchs. In particular, the monarchs became ever more dependent on the estates to approve their finances and approve their rights to levy taxes, for which the monarch had henceforth to summon the estates in order to grant him money. And in Poland, and here Poland critically diverged from the rest of the European continent, the king was also forced by the Diet to make the nobles entirely exempt from any laws of the realm. So until the 1480s, developments throughout the European kingdoms were more or less evolving in similar ways. Even in that odd construction, the Holy Roman Empire. It may be tempting to read the situation in the 18th century, when the empire had become little more than a loose array of independent states, back into the 15th century. But in the 15th century, the Reichstag still had considerable authority. And in the late 15th century, attempts were being made to introduce both an imperial financial system and an imperial army and an imperial supreme court, the Aulic Council, while the Reichstag prohibited private feuding. Had events turned out slightly differently, the Holy Roman Empire might well have evolved into a viable state. And it is roughly from that point on that the developments began to diverge within Europe. Basically, and this is indeed very basically, since I have to sum up entire libraries here, in Spain, in Portugal, in France, and in Denmark, the king's administration got ever more powerful. It started to raise its own taxes, and finally did not convoke the estates at all anymore. The historians call this development the rise of absolutism, and it is commonly argued this rise of absolutism is typical for all of Europe. The decisive period for Spain, Portugal, and France were here surely the 1640s, a whole group of uprisings of both the nobility and of the cities against the encroachment of royal authority on their privileges. In both Catalonia and Portugal, nobles and estates tried to split off from Spain. In Catalonia's case, unsuccessfully. In Portugal's case, successfully. But the endless war with Spain, which ensued on that, allowed the Portuguese monarchy to push the Cortes entirely aside. In France, first the estates, and then the nobility, rose up in a confused series of uprisings called the Fronde. Uprisings that were smothered in blood by the royal army. However, absolutism was by no means on the ascent in all of Europe. While England and Sweden were drifting in the direction of absolutism from the 16th century on, in England, that slide towards absolutism was halted by a civil war between king and parliament, which was, unlike the Fronde, won by parliament. And in Sweden, the slide towards absolutism was halted by King Charles XII's death in the Great Nordic War between Sweden, Poland and Russia. After that, Queen Ulrika Eleonora had in 1719 to concede the Swedish Diet far-reaching powers to decide on budget and on the laws. Again, the Holy Roman Empire collapsed after the ultimate attempt of the emperor to unite the empire under Austrian rule during the Thirty Years' War. In the Netherlands, the Estates General in 1581, solemnly abjured the King of Spain, and it declared the country a republic. In Poland, the power of the king steadily withered away, until the sachem could block any decision of the king, and Poland then became what may be called a noble republic, of which the king, who was now elected by the nobility, was merely a nominal head. Commonwealth called upon somebody who had already distinguished himself to become king of Poland-Lithuania, and lest an irresponsible majority impose its view on the minority and would thus reintroduce tyranny by the back door, Poland furthermore introduced the unique principle of liberty of dissent, in which any member of the sachem, by saying "I do not agree," could block decisions of the majority. That worked well enough in the 17th and 16th century, but it became a major problem in the 18th century, where members of the sachem, often bribed by foreign monarchs, could block any decision to their disadvantage. In Italy, developments diverged. Genoa, Lucca, and Venice remained republics, while Florence came under the increasingly absolute rule of the Medici family. And with this, arguably, also withered that freedom of expression that had originally produced the Florentine Renaissance. Naples and Milan were Spanish and later on Austrian possessions that were by and large controlled by the nobility. And then there were, of course, the Papal States. And then there was Switzerland. Absolutism, in other words, succeeded in some places. It caused the disintegration of the Holy Roman Empire. It never existed in Poland at all, or in most of Italy. It was defeated in England, and it collapsed in Sweden. To a large extent, absolutism is, historian Nicholas Henshaw has argued, a convenient weak myth, elaborated by 18th and 19th century British historians to show that the entire continent was drifting to slavery, while the English were evolving those magnificent free institutions that freed them from despotic abuse. Furthermore, Henshaw argues, even the supposed absolute monarchs were constrained by extensive constitutional limitations to their rule, as opposed to another bugbear in the literature I shall be dealing with in the next two lectures, the despotism supposedly prevailing in Russia and in the Orient. Nonetheless, there were some common trends in 16th and 17th century Europe, trends which indeed favored a stronger central authority, and that directly led to the all-pervasive state of today, even in states which stood very far from absolutism, such as the Dutch Republic or Poland. For, as sociologist Charles Tilly said, with some justification, in the 16th and 17th centuries, war made the state, and the state made war. Indeed, the common pursuit of states in Europe in the 16th and 17th century was summed up by Jonathan Swift in Culliver's Travels as follows. This is worth a long quote, as it well sums up European policy from the 16th into the 18th century. Quote, "What were the usual causes or motives that made one country go to war with another? I answered. They were innumerable, but I should only mention a few of the chiefs. Sometimes the ambition of princes, who never think they have land or people enough to govern. Sometimes the corruption of ministers, who engage their masters in a war in order to stifle or divert the clamor of their subjects against their evil administration. Differences in opinion have cost many millions of lives. For instance, whether flesh be bread or bread be flesh, whether the juice of a certain berry be blood or wine, whether whistling be a vice or a virtue, what is the best color for a coat, whether black, white, red or gray. Neither are any wars so furious and bloody, or of so long a continuance, as those occasioned by differences in opinion, especially if it be in things indifferent. Sometimes the quarrel between two princes is to decide which of them shall dispossess a third of his dominion, whether neither of them pretend to any right. Sometimes one prince quarrels with another for fear the other should quarrel with him. If a prince sends forces into a nation where the people are poor and ignorant, he may lawfully put half of them to death and make slaves of the rest in order to civilize them and reduce them from their barbarous way of living. Alliance by blood or marriage is a frequent cause of war between princes. For all these reasons, the trait of a soldier is held the most honorable of all others, because a soldier is hired to kill in cold blood, as many of his own species who have never offended him as possibly he can." End quote. And all that applied to the Dutch Republic as much as to France and Spain. That the trait of the soldier to kill as many people of his own blood as possible became the most honored profession in Europe was caused by what historians often call the military revolution. First came a revolution in tactics in the late 15th century, the replacement of the lance and the pike by the arrow and the musket, as feudal knights fell before the firepower of masked archers or gunners, and far more importantly, in the art of siege warfare, where cannons could now quickly knock down the city walls that could previously hold back armies for years and years. In the early 16th century there was, to be sure, a new kind of fortress developed to counter the effects of artillery, the Tras Italien, or Star Fort. But such a Tras Italien was extremely expensive to build, and above all, to maintain, unlike medieval walls that could be built or repaired in an instant. And furthermore, a city surrounded by a Tras Italien was cramped within the bastion and had no further possibilities to expand, so that most cities in Europe abstained from laying out these expensive fortifications and preferred them merely constructed in contested frontier regions. City walls henceforth mainly served to demarcate the jurisdictions of cities rather than for their defense. Associated with this development, there was a market increase in army size all across Europe, and the armed forces of several states increased tenfold between 1500 and 1700, and the adoption of ever more ambitious and complex strategies that were designed to bring these ever larger armies into action, and those revolved around military drill, ceaselessly repeating the same action until it became second nature to a soldier. Much as learning to drive also revolves around drilling certain actions into somebody until they do not need any more thought. Partly, such drill was undoubtedly necessary. The 16th and 17th century arquebus was an extremely complicated weapon to fire, and it required the soldier to perform a large number of actions almost mindlessly, as an automaton, just as driving a car. However, it is also arguable armies insisted so much on drills because all that drill could henceforth no longer be left to amateurs, but only to professionals trained in it their entire life. Professionals meant the former knightly aristocracy, which in this way reinvented a new function for itself after they had been slaughtered time and time over again when they were still knights in the 15th century. For accepting the case of Cromwell's new model army, armies were, and were to remain, aristocratic preserves right into the 20th century. Fourth and finally, the military revolution dramatically accentuated the impact of war on society. The greater costs incurred, the greater damage inflicted, and the greater administrative challenge posed by the augmented armies made waging war far more of a burden and far more of a problem than ever previously, both for the civilian populations and for their rulers. In some respects, it was a very similar situation as with the military-industrial complexes of the Cold War. First, states had to build huge armies to protect against their neighbors. But once they had these very expensive armies, it was no use having them idle, and they better let them loose on their neighbors. Thus, European states lapsed into an endless cycle of wars that tended to be self-reinforcing, because when one area was ravaged by war, its inhabitants often had no choice but to seek the profession of a soldier. They were hence ready to be recruited to pursue the war, on and on. In the classic case of the 30 Years' War, while the whole of Germany was being reduced to rubble, the armies just kept on growing, since ever more people of areas that were just reduced to rubble enlisted in them. To pay these ever-increasing armies, all states had to look for more revenue. Thus, for example, the English budget expanded from £126,000 in 1210 to £2 million in 1680. And by comparison, counted in pounds too, that of France increased from 1.9 million to 6.2 million. That of the Dutch Republic from 700,000 in 1580 to 3 million in 1680. And that of Castile rose from 296,000 in 1510 to a pinnacle of 4 million around 1600, and then dropped to 1.4 million in 1690. In the beginning of the 16th century, these sums could still be covered from lands in possession of the crown and revenues in possession of the crown. Thus, in 1510, 80% of English crown revenue were obtained from crown possessions. But as armies became ever bigger, the crown, or for that matter the estates, had to think of other ways to fleece their inhabitants more thoroughly. Thus, in 1710, 98% of British revenue was derived from taxes. Here was the rub. In the 16th to 18th century, European governments required ever more taxes from their inhabitants. Taxes they commonly expended on wars that were commonly of little or no use or profit to the inhabitants, and that merely serves the glory of their sovereigns. There were three ways of getting these revenues together, and they somewhat tally with the constitutional developments we have just been considering. One way was taking out loans, and one country, which indeed initially succeeded in managing war expenses, by and large by lending, was the Dutch Republic in the beginning of the 8 years war with Spain, as the public in Holland was basically willing to fund patriotic loans to fight a war on the expense of the province of Brabant, where all fighting took place, lest the Spanish armies would reappear under the walls of the Dutch cities. However, the patriotic fervor of the population began to ebb later on, and the Republic was now forced to impose ever heavier taxes on its population, and particularly indirect taxes, which made the Dutch Republic by 1700 the most heavily taxed country in all of Europe. In my view, the main cause of the economic decline of the Republic in the 18th century, as these were mostly indirect taxes, which made almost all products from the Republic too expensive by 1720. The Dutch case and the constant Spanish bankruptcies we have reviewed already demonstrate that lending was on the long run no viable strategy. The second way was tax farming. I need to explain this. Tax farming means that you sell the right to collect taxes in an area, or some particular tax, salt say, or in playing cards, to a private entrepreneur, who then may take his pick of the tax revenue. The best explanation I can find to illustrate the rationale of tax farming is comparing it to the almost tax farming-like ways the United States Army behaved during the invasion of Iraq, where the USA optioned the right to service canteens or guard government buildings to private firms, both because, as these were operating at a profit, for profit, it would be cheaper to have it run by a private organization than by the army, which after all doesn't mind profit, and because these private organizations would then have to shoulder the risks as well. Similarly, governments in the 16th and 17th centuries auctioned the rights to taxation, as it was both cheaper and as the tax farmer shouldered the risks, aside from which the government, in case it did not like the tax farmer too much, might seize his assets, as happened, for example, to the main financier of Louis XIII and Louis XIV, Nicolas Fouquet, all whose assets were seized by Louis XIV, after he had famously received him with a party that had made even the king jealous. Though his main rival, Jean-Baptiste Colbert, or what we might now call the Colbert Group of bankers, had also done everything to blacken his reputation. Those tax farmers were without any doubt the single most hated group in both France and Spain. Peasants' riots, and even the still very common peasants' uprisings, always involved putting the houses of tax farmers on fire first. However, the tax farmers were also a rather small, closed group. Nobles or peoples with noble pretensions, such as Colbert, who was of comfortable bourgeois background, but not a noble himself. Third, the state might collect taxes itself, and for that it needed a bureaucracy, and in particular, it needed people trained in the law for that. Partly these could still be trained in the old universities of Europe. Partly too, new universities were founded, such as the University of Leiden, or the new University of Évora in Portugal, or the brand new red brick University of Wittenberg in Halle, in Saxony, for which the curator of the university, as they could not find any better known professor, named an unknown monk, who had no publications to his credit whatsoever, to the chair of theology. His name was Martin Luther. Being a student was in the 16th century as expensive as it is nowadays. And these old and new universities thus did not occlude amongst the very dregs of society. The average university graduate in the 16th century was somebody of merchants or goutmaster's background, but going to university was nonetheless, as it had has remained until the last decade of the previous century, a stairway to social ascent. And such people, of at least by noble terms lowly descent, were therefore despised by the nobility, while the university graduates often despised the nobles in turn, who could not even say converse in Latin. There thus arose something of a new class. Whereas the European upper class had so far consisted, the city-states accepted, of nobles, they were now joined by a new class, known in France as the nobles of the robe, as against the old nobility of the shoulders, or as the letrados versus grandes in Spain. And while the grandes were whiling their time away on military campaigns abroad, even in the Americas, the letrados ran the country. They manned the bench, they collected the taxes, or in the 18th century they were engaged bloodletting people. For the idea of a professional society, that is, that occupations are protected by the diplomas and linked to high status, can be traced back to the lawyers of the nobles of the robe, who were, in the course of the 18th century, gradually joined by doctors. Now, in the course of the 16th century, this new nobility of the robe erected an elaborate edifice of doctrines to defend the power of the king, and thus defend their own function as well, such as Jean Bodin's Six Books of the Republic, in which he argued that if any prince was subject to the will of the estates, he would therefore not be a sovereign, that is, have the right to emit laws without emendations, as a lawgiver is obviously able to change his own law. The nobles of the robe and the king could therefore push the customary laws aside, for which they derived their justification, above all, from Roman law, as codified in Justinian's reign. That was one of the most despotic regimes ever erected. Indeed, carrying out Roman law was a permanent guarantee for introducing despotism, as intellectuals from the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth then already repeatedly pointed out. However, later on, as this group of lawyers had become well entrenched in the administration, and we're here talking about the 18th century, they became increasingly critical of a royal administration they had themselves helped erect, and thought increasingly too it was their task to defend the subjects against tyranny. By the mid-18th century, therefore, the lawyers who had originally built the royal administration became its most severe critics. Now, this need to tax the population and thus get rid of all the myriad tax exemptions to either groups or localities had as a further consequence that governments needed an ever more standardized population, where basically anybody within the boundary of a territory is the same. I shall deal with the nation later, as the great jump in standardizing populations was made in the 19th century with conscription. Yet the concept of the nation was already in the air in the 17th century, though the then term for what now might be called a nation was oddly a republic, even if the place were a kingdom. One component of making a nation was a national economic policy, in which as much advantages as possible should accrue to one's own country. You would thus have to erect high tariff walls around your country and stimulate trade by the erection of monopoly organizations and reserve freight as much as possible to ships from one's own country and attract as much precious metals to it as possible, since the volume of trade depended on the volume of precious metals a country had. Historians have labeled this policy mercantilism, although I should immediately point out there is a whole school of historians that claimed it never existed. Mercantilism can, if you like, be traced back all the way to the 14th century, but it really became state policy and emerged as dominant view on the economy in the 1620s. In Spain, Portugal, England, Sweden and France, though never in the Dutch Republic, which obviously was the great economic winner of the 17th century, or in Poland, which came far too much from its free trade in grain, or in such mercantile city-states as Venice or Genoa. As the economic clouds over Europe increasingly began to darken, and Europe began to slip into a prolonged depression, which stretched from 1620 to roughly 1690, and arguably even up to the mid-18th century, in some ways governments reacted as they did to the Great Depression of the 1930s of the 20th century. With a shrinking economic pie, everybody wants to secure as large a piece of it as possible, and thus everybody started to erect laws to pester the competitors away and seclude them behind custom barriers. However, mercantilism was also a program. It was intended to develop a national economic space. On the one hand, it therefore wanted to abolish internal custom duties. This is another such thing which may be hard to fathom for listeners. But in the 16th and 17th century, any road you traveled on would be replete with local custom stations, or with what was called staple rights, that is, the right of a city to seize goods passing through and offer them for sale there. This was commonly secured by rights of privileges to cities that were granted, say, 500 years ago. For example, if you made the same trip as cruisers on the Rhine, that modern tourist trip, take now, you would have to pay customs at 14 different places, and the cities of Cologne and Koblenz had staple rights. On the other hand, the policy of mercantilism was intended to reserve the trade of a country only to merchants and carriers from that country, of which the aim, of course, was to pester the main carriers in the 17th century, the Dutch, out of trade, if necessary, by force. And the Dutch, obviously, retaliated to that by force, as when the Dutch, for example, intervened in the Danish-Swedish War in 1658 to secure free passage, which Sweden likely would interdict, through the Sund, and defeated the Swedish fleet in the Battle of the Sund, which is shown in the picture to this lecture. Again, it is arguable that, though Louis XIV's wars were partly no doubt triggered by his personal ambition, they were also intended to break the stranglehold of Dutch merchants on French trade. Another component of an incipient policy of forming national state was a policy to standardize such things as measures used in, or coins used in, and even the language of a territory, as well as to encode its national customs. The classic example is the Académie Française, that was established by the Cardinal de Richelieu in 1635. The task of the Académie Française was to standardize the writing and the grammar of the French language that had so far varied by territory, and thus fix a standard of civilized French spoken all over France. After all, even as late as the 19th century, Provençal-speaking peasants summoned in front of a local court still needed an interpreter for French, let alone that anybody could grasp Breton. Now, as any learner of French has noted, and to his despair, the Académie Française on the one hand fixed on as elaborate a spelling as possible, and it attempted to purge the language both of dialects and of Latin loanwords. This has had the positive effect of at least standardizing French spelling, and it has had perhaps the further positive effect that while in the English spoken in England, the accent one speaks immediately betrays one's class, in France this is far less so. It had, however, the negative effect of demoting any regional dialect to barbaric patois or argot. The French example was later on followed by Spain in 1713, tellingly immediately after it had its first French king, and by Russia in 1723. In England, this work was obviously left to the free initiative of Dr. Samuel Johnson, while Italian, uniquely in Europe, had already more or less fixed on using Tuscan as general civilized Italian, though Venice typically persisted in using its own dialect. Yet if also things may perhaps be deemed positive, depending of course on what one thinks of French spelling, and particularly the abolition of the internal custom duties and local mint rights of towns may be deemed positive, concomitant to that went an increasing intolerance towards minorities. And it is here that Eastern Europe critically differs from Western Europe. For example, the Netherlands traditionally values itself on its exceptional tolerance, something it has supposedly inherited from the 17th century, and that certainly applies to the cosmopolitan metropolis of Amsterdam, as that city valued anybody who brought money, and in particular it welcomed Jews. Without any doubt, the city was the great Jewish metropolis of Western Europe, while Jews were not allowed into England until 1656, and an act of parliament allowing naturalization of Jews in 1752 was within a few weeks repealed again. The Netherlands was certainly tolerant, except for the largest minority by far, and some historians actually think the number of Catholics in the Dutch Republic outnumbered that of Protestants. For Catholics were not allowed to openly practice their religion, and they had to attend churches in hiding, churches disguised as houses. Though I ought immediately to add that Catholics were not persecuted in the Netherlands, nevertheless, even in the Netherlands, toleration had limits. For if Jews were no peril to anybody, the Catholics, as a potential fourth column for the King of Spain or France, were. Again, England is another country that traditionally values itself on its toleration. But that certainly did not apply to Catholics, and least of all to Catholics in Ireland. They were subjected to harsh persecution. Catholics were excluded from Parliament, from bench and bar, from army and navy, from all civil offices, from corporations, and even from corporate towns. Catholics could not have Catholic schools at home, or attend foreign schools, or inherit landed property, or hold land on the lease, or act as executors or administrators, or have arms or ammunition, or even a horse. In other words, states in Western Europe began to demand increasing conformity from their inhabitants, and in this way they laid the foundation to the national states that arose in Western Europe. However, in Eastern Europe the trend was in the precise opposite direction. For what arose there were not so much embryonic national states as rather loosely structured multinational empires. Multinational empires that, far from demanding unilateral allegiance from their inhabitants, thrived on diversity. For basically, while a national state needs to enforce uniformity, empires are built on the divide and rule principle. The more minorities there are, the more divided they are, the better for the empire. It can then, after all, pose as universal arbitrator. Thus, whereas Western European states were tearing themselves asunder in religious quarrels, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, as only state in Europe, proclaimed full religious liberty in the Warsaw Confederation Act of 1573, in which again, uniquely in Europe, practicing Islam was permitted. And there is in fact still a minute Muslim community in Lithuania, descendants of Islamic mercenary troops enlisted by the Commonwealth in the 16th century, who speak a Turkish dialect akin to that spoken in the Tatar Autonomous Region of Russia. Most importantly though, Poland-Lithuania not only permitted Jewish religion since 1505, but actually encouraged settlement of Jews in Poland, while Jews were granted complete autonomy to rule themselves by rabbinic law. That ensued in a great renaissance of Jewish scholarship that influences self-definitions of Jews and indeed European or US culture right at this very day. For this legal autonomy encouraged many Jews to pursue careers as rabbinic scholars, and the Jews have profited from this tradition of learning right until the present day. Now, to explain why Western and Eastern Europe took such divergent paths towards unified national states in Western Europe and multinational empires in Eastern Europe, you may partly look at the second serfdom that I discussed before. But the geography is critical as well. Ever since the great phase of high medieval expansion of agriculture, Western Europe had become a densely tilled land, precisely demarcated plots of land, separated by equally neatly demarcated forests. But the grasslands of Eastern Europe, and particularly those of present Ukraine, of Hungary, and much of Romania, were much tougher to cultivate with plough, as the sort of those grasslands offers severe resistance to a plough, and necessitates a large team of horses and men to work it. Thus, the further east you come, the thinner populations became, to finally give way to the westernmost region of the great Eurasian steppes, pushed out of Hungary and the Pontic steppes, that in the 16th century covered much of present Ukraine. Those Pontic steppes were the traditional home of Turkish-speaking Normans, who were joined from the 14th century on by another semi-nomadic people. They were called Cossacks. It is somewhat disputed where the Cossacks originally derived from, but they seem to stem from nomadic groups enlisted by both Muscovy and Poland-Lithuania, who had converted to Orthodoxy and later on were joined by refugee serfs and mercenaries. Now, while most blocks of pikemen might be the worst way of fighting musketeers and heavily armored and thus very slow cavalry, they are clearly of little use fighting horse archers, and particularly expert horse archers who have honed their skills for centuries. They can simply pick off your infantry as it advances, and they retreat if the infantry comes too near. To fight such cavalry, you need other cavalry, and in particular a force of light cavalry to screen your force as it advances, and armored lancers to charge the horse archers, who you then can run down with your light cavalry. In Polish, such light cavalry
what was called hussars. Furthermore, the counter-step nomads, who have been taught archery and horse riding since early childhood, you also need a class of people who have trained horse riding since early childhood too. When you cannot enlist other steppe nomads to do the fighting for you, and that was the common system of countering them, you must therefore rear a professional class of warriors who are trained in the way of fighting of the steppes, and who, because of that, feel themselves far removed from the peasants they have to protect. States adjacent to steppe warriors have to be big states furthermore, because basically in a tribe every male is also a horse archer, whereas in the admittedly far more populous states which they bordered on, fighting on horseback was something for the minuscule noble minority. The armies of small states could thus be easily overcome by armies of nomads, and the only way of countering them were the kind of large empires that arose in Eastern Europe, for only they could muster the strength to overcome steppe nomads. That they were completely separate from the rest of the population was actually recognized by the nobility of these empires too, as with the Polish-Lithuanian nobility that maintained that while the despised peasants might be Polish, or even worse Lithuanian, they were the direct descendants from the legendary Sarmatians who had roamed the Pontic steppes in Roman times. It was a fable, of course, but what the Lithuanian and Polish nobility well recognized was that they were in a way an artificial steppe people maintained by revenue from grain exports to Genoa or to the Dutch Republic. And yet, on this point I ought to pay tribute to Poland. The Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth has enjoyed a very bad press, be it because of Second Serfdom, be it because it collapsed in the 18th century. And yet, agrarian historian Emmett Jones has sailed a rather bizarre course over the last 30 years. First he wrote a book in which he argued that European growth was completely unique to Europe, and that conditions to it were only available in Europe, and that never, and would never occur anywhere else in world history ever again. Then Jones wrote a second book, in which he argued that the very same preconditions to growth occurred in several other places too, Tokugawa Japan and Ming China, amongst others. And you can obviously not have your cake and eat it too. Either Europe was unique, or it was nothing exceptional. However, to explain why Europe took off and why China did not, Jones offered a plausible hypothesis, and that is that Europe was spared the rule of a steppe nomad dynasty, while China or Russia were not, and that set them back for several centuries. Now, there is something to that argument. Nobody is going to improve his fields if these fields are likely to be ransacked and burned by invading Tartars the next year. And this argument could be extended into the 17th, indeed the 18th century. Western Europe could engage in its own petty quarrels, which the Europeans called the Reformation, or indeed embark on maritime discoveries, because it did not have steppe nomads on its doorstep. And those steppe nomads were jointly kept away from Western Europe by the armies of Poland, Lithuania and Muscovy. The Poles may not have saved Western civilization, as they like to claim, for the dynasties that were of steppe nomadic descent, and that we'll treat in the next lecture, were every bit as civilized as any in the West, and they were commonly far less warlike. Yet they may have saved European expansion and perhaps European capitalism.